1, 2, 3, go! Give me a ticket for a podcast. Ain't got time to make this joke last. Lonely days are gone. I'm a going home. My baby is a ranking the Beatles.
Oh, that was a good one.
Thank you.
Yeah, you made me laugh right at the top.
I was going for something a little more gravelly, because this is a very polleny episode of Ranking the Beatles. welcome, everybody, to the height of allergy season here in New Orleans.
Achoo.
Yes, indeed. Hope everybody is doing well. We're doing okay here. You all right today? How are you feeling?
I'm fine. Your sinuses are another situation.
Yeah, it's been a thing for a few days, as it is multiple times per year here in New Orleans. But, you know, we're going to power through and do our best today, because that's what you deserve, friends. You guys deserve the best, I think. Do you agree, Julie?
Yeah.
Nothing but the best for our listeners?
Absolutely.
You got it. Well, welcome everybody to episode 75 of Ranking the Beatles. I'm your host, Jonathan, over here to my left, somewhere in the middle of your headphone spectrum, not sure where she is, or just coming at you straight out of your phone or whatever you're listening to. My beautiful wife, Julia, how are you?
Straight into your face.
Straight into your face.
That's I'm good.
Kind of the best way to receive the Julia experience. Straight
into
in the face.
Your face.
Yeah.
It's kind of intense.
But also fitting.
Okay, that's accurate.
I'll give
that's
you that.
Fine.
I think
Thank
so.
You.
Yeah.
I think.
It's a compliment.
Okay, good.
Well, welcome everybody. Hope you're all doing well. If this is your first time to the show, what we do here is we've got a list of 223 songs recorded by the Beatles that I ranked from least favorite to most favorite. And every show we have a different guest and we talk about the next song in the rankings. So, yeah, that's what we do. We're here to do it again today. Our guest this week is a Canadian-American recording artist, producer, recording and mix engineer, and author living in Toronto. In addition to writing the books The Beatles Recording Reference Manuals, he's a contributing writer in the area of audio production and mixing for Sonic Scoop and Produce Like a Pro. He's presented his multimedia breakdowns of classic Beatles songs at academic conferences and events all over North America. He's known for his advanced understanding of vintage recording techniques and their application in the digital domain. So you can learn more about his work as a mix engineer and everything that that entails at jerryhammock.com. That's his website. His music is at throttlebodymc.com. And of course, you can find out more about his fantastic books, The Beatles Recording Reference Manuals, at beatlesrecordingreferencemanuals.com. Number 5, I believe, is the most recent one that's just come out in the last few months. So if you are a nerd like me and you'd like to find out how the Beatles sausage is made, or vegan sausage, if it's Paul, the Linda McCartney sausage, I guess, check out his books. They are a beautiful biblical reference for all these recording sessions and how they do it and everything like that. And I can't wait to dive into to find out how he learns all this. How does he find out all this stuff? So I'm stoked about it. Let's get into it, friends. Please welcome to the show, Jerry Hammock. Jerry, welcome to Ranking the Beatles. How are you, man?
Doing great. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Happy to have you. So glad we could connect. How have you been? How are things going? How's life in your neck of the woods these days?
Life is good. Life is good. Busy with a couple of three book projects.
Wow.
Yeah, let's call it three book projects. And releasing music and mixing music and doing all that good stuff. So when I can keep myself busy in the arts and writing and music and that, I'm a happy man.
Nice.
So I'm a happy man.
That's awesome.
You don't get brain scrambled working on three books at the same time?
No, I'm fairly good. Ask my wife at compartmentalizing.
Nice.
Do you have like separate like notebooks or like however you sort of collect your information for each
for
project?
Sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now a couple of them are Beatles projects, so those do have some overlap that happens with them. The other writing project is associated with home studio recording.
Nice.
And so that one is, it's completely its own thing. Mm-hmm. So I am able to kind of pick my fights with each day of writing or whatever I'm doing to turn off one project and turn on another. And so far so good. I'm hoping this Christmas, at least one of the projects will be out, and perhaps two. Yeah, let's do that.
Nice. That's some high shooting, though. Like, well done.
Yeah, that's amazing.
To get all that out at one time. That's great.
Well, I was thinking the other day of how, you know, there is a season, right? And and right now I'm sowing it.
Nice.
And hopefully then everyone, Beatles fans especially, can reap the rewards later on. So
beautiful.
There we go.
And I know you just recently put out volume 5 of the recording reference manuals. Is that correct?
Yeah, the last one. Very happy to get that almost 11-year project completed. Those have been unexpectedly well received.
Mm-hmm.
It constantly surprises me where I hear people are using it, enjoying it, referencing it, which is what it's meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a page turner.
Right. It's a very like niche thing. Like, yeah.
But if you want to know, you know, the whole idea behind it is first take to final mix. Like, how do they make these songs?
Mm-hmm.
And it surprised me how many people were looking for that information. I mean, knew for myself that I was filling in a gap mm-hmm. in the scholarship that while there were pieces of this story, there wasn't ever the complete story. And then a lot of the stories that were being told were just not quite right.
Yeah.
And so, it was almost 11 years sorting it out and lining it up. And, you know, everything had to make sense. You know, everything, all the facts had to kind of line up before I was like, I can trust this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can trust this information. And then, of course, I wanted the bar to be high. Like, it isn't just I think.
Mm-hmm. Right.
in fact there's pretty much no I think in it. If I don't know it, or I can't give you a definitive answer of what's happening in a session or with a song, then I state that clearly, that, you know, there's no information on this.
Yeah.
And then, you know, with the 5 volumes out, for the 4 previous ones, the 5th one's just starting to get some feedback as far as, did I miss something? And, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces, and I certainly, you know, there certainly have been some pickups. So sure. If any of your listeners out there, you know, have bought the books earlier and are like, want to have the most up to date, go to the website, which is BeatlesRecordingReferenceManuals.com, and there are free downloads of the updates that I have done.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, because I'll get emails of someone to be like, challenging me on what I've written.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm willing to, you know, I'm happy to be challenged in what I've written. You've got to give me chapter and verse, though.
Right.
I've given you chapter and verse. So, in a few cases, that's, you know, that has, it's come across. I've recognized where, you know, better information's come out.
Yeah.
And so I've updated the books, and yeah, that's available for people if they're interested.
Nice.
Free.
Yeah, that's great.
Download cool. the PDF, download the PDF, slip it in your volume. Don't buy a new one.
Well, welcome to this podcast that is pure opinion.
Right.
We only exist.
I've got lots of opinions too.
Excellent. So. Excellent. You save them for the podcast. Well,
how did the reference manual idea come about for you? And also how are you getting, I guess what's the secret for the access to the material that you are working with? Like, have you been able to like go to the vaults and look through session, you know, notes and everything like that?
No, they don't know me. You know, well, I've developed some relationships with Abbey Road
mm-hmm.
and with the folks at Apple,
mm-hmm.
But you know, when I was doing this and started again, started 11, you know, years ago down the road, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm nobody. So, you know, hello, Abbey Road. Can I, or, you know, hello, EMI. Can I come look at your tape vault? It's like, yeah, probably not. But the detective work came from as many sources that I could track down that I could validate that made sense. Mm-hmm. I pretty much, so I'll start with your, I'll answer your first question first. Why did I even start down this road? I work as a producer and a recording engineer, and inevitably, because I work in rock and pop music, it's a rare session that I don't hear, you know, hey, I really would like, you know, I'd like that vocal to sound like Lennon's on Day in the Life, or mm-hmm. I'd like that guitar, you know, can I get McCartney's bass tone on whatever, Paperback Writer or something, right? And you get those things. And when you're being asked to record someone and they ask you that, you know, can you get me that? The answer is always yes. Oh, right. Sure. Sure. Pepper bass tone? You know, I'll have it for you tomorrow. Well, you know, we'll dial that in. So, you know, mad scramble to get that information and figure it out and try to get it right. So that happens more often than not. Now I had some time on my hands and I started looking into a few of these things and just out of my own curiosity, because I'm a Beatles fan. I mean, I love them. I grew up with them. And it came to me of like, you know, while you're figuring that one out, why don't you just figure out the rest of it? You know, like how much time could that take?
Right.
Whoops. I've got 20 minutes to kill.
Yeah. And
let's
so
just get into
that
it.
That just kind of started me down the rabbit hole then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gathered as many recordings I could of the, you know, of bootlegs and release versions and all of that. I ended up with about well over 5,000 tracks.
Wow.
And so that information, you know, of course there are some foundational pieces that you know, Lewison did, mm-hmm. Babak did, that John Wynn did, that Walter Everett did, that McDonald did. So there's some, you know, foundational pieces there. And then anything else I could get my hand on, I could find interviews where they're talking about a song or, you know, those kinds of things. I just gathered all of that information and started taking notes about it associated with songs. Slowly it started to take form. Initially, it was just data. All I was gathering was data. It was on this day, in this studio, with these people, this gear, you know, lining all of those things up. Mm-hmm. So if 1964, if in Studio 2, if with Ken Scott Engineering, then what microphones are being used, you know, what gear is being used, because, you know, there's gear, you know, gear came and went, mm-hmm. as far as like dominant gear came and went. So getting all of those things lined up and I grabbed all of the photographic, you know, evidence I could find, all of the film and video evidence that I could find, mm-hmm. video evidence that I could find. So all of those different sources. And then I filtered it as to, especially with the written stuff, if it was before Lewison, you can pretty much throw it away.
Right, right.
So before 85, you know, and this is only if it isn't original source material. Mm-hmm. If it isn't a photo of them on this date in this place.
Right.
Or an interview with them, you know, kind of in a real time things. But someone who wrote about them and what they were doing and tried to be authoritative in 1973, you know, like I, there was one book out there, and the name escapes me, and I don't want to, you know, be here bad mouthing people either. That was top, that said that Harrison played the fiddle on Don't Pass Me By.
What?
Well, and it's just, you know, again, there's that impulse to fill in the gaps, right?
Right, right.
You know, well, one of them had to do it. George did it. And that's something that I really fought against in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I was like, if you don't know who did it, then you got to say you don't know who did it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, or if you don't know what, a lot of people that have criticized my work, it'll be on the lines of like a guitar player that when I've put in the book that it could have been, Harrison could have been playing at this point on this song, his Tennessean or his Country Gentleman. And they'll be like, oh man, I can tell a P90 from a humbucker, you know?
It's like,
And I'm like, well, yeah. Except now that P90 or that humbucker is going through an amplifier. Now that amplifier is getting mic'd by a certain microphone. That microphone is going into a console. The console is applying EQ to it. After the EQ, that's going into a compressor. Now can you tell your P90 from your humbucker?
Right.
And, you know, maybe. But I'm not willing to say definitively that that's it. So I say, here's the guitars that were available. That's the way that I address those conflicts. Mm-hmm. I don't tell you what I don't know. I give you the possibilities.
Yeah.
And, but you know, Beatles guys, they're Beatle people.
there's strong opinions, obviously.
There's strong opinions. Yeah. I think the term is Beatle police.
Yeah,
Beatle police of like, you know, checking that I've got it, that I'm doing it right.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my god.
And again, some of those guys and gals that have approached me, they have helped. Mm-hmm. And I don't want anyone to think that I think that I've that like I got it nailed. I got it close.
Yeah.
The nail's almost completely sunk into the plywood, but I'm willing to, you know, I'm always willing to be wrong. And I know that for Beatles fans and scholars that are have that level of interest, mm-hmm. that this stuff's important.
Yeah.
And it's important to me too. So, I mean, I kind of, you know, I joke about it because what else are you going to do? But I do, you know, I take the work seriously. I want to get it right. When I realized that this was filling in a gap in the scholarship, then like any other, you know, aspirational nonfiction writer, I was like, I want this to be the last book that anyone has to write mm-hmm. about this topic or the last books that anyone has to write. And I think I'm pretty close.
Yeah.
So, you know, time will tell.
Well, that is absolutely fantastic. As a musician and a Beatles nerd, I've been in that same position for years of like, oh man, how do we get, you know, the drum sounds on Revolver or something like that, you know, and always wanted to try to figure out how to get those tones. And it's, I'm so glad to see, you know, that you've done the work on that and that it's out there and other nerds like myself can get that answer when they're looking for it.
Yeah. The unexpected joy that I've got in this is from people like you. And then when I'll hear about like these producers that I have, you know, that like I idolize mm-hmm. and they've got my books.
Oh, nice.
And that blows my mind mm-hmm. of they're looking through my books about how to get, you know, because I don't do like the formula or the recipes or anything like that. That's not what these books are about. These books are the facts. Mm-hmm. That's what they are. They're the facts. But, you know, a producer looking at, you know, looking at it, can build a sound, a signal chain. You know, a producer looking at it can build a signal chain that will let them reproduce it because they know what they're doing with that. Like right. I would, you know, like I could do that
right.
With it. So yeah. So when these, you know, producers that have like, you know, done, recorded and worked with artists that I, you know, would drool to work with, that I would pay them to work with. Don't tell anybody.
Right.
you know, that they are, you know, they've got my books. They enjoy my books. They use them. Like that's, you know, mission accomplished for my ego at least.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. A huge compliment. Big time.
Yeah.
So how did the Beatles enter your sphere? What's kind of the backstory on that for you? Oh,
I mean, I absolutely grew up with them. So I'm a child of the 60s. I was born in 61, old mm-hmm. man. I was actually, my nickname in my family was the Beatle Baby because I had a huge shock of curly hair. Like at age one, I had, you know, like a massive head of ringlets. And they didn't cut it till I think I was four or something like that. And so the Beatles had come along and they called me Beatle Baby. And so I heard that. So that was there. Of course, in the house we had, my sister is 8 years older than me, and she had Meet the Beatles and the Beatles' second album, and those were, you know, I heard those all the time. Mm-hmm. Probably my most visceral really early memory of a kind of a Beatles thing that like it's still with me was there was a children's show out in Seattle called Wunda Wunda, and she was like some kind of fairy witch sort of thing, and she had puppets that would sing songs in one segment of her show. And there was a segment where the puppets were singing, "It Won't Be Long." And so you had, "It nice. Won't Be Long, yeah, 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 yeah," right? Just, and I mean, that just absolutely, you know, registered me. This is pre-Muppets, of course. Yeah. So, yeah, my earliest memories, standing on a fireplace mantle and with tennis racket. Mm-hmm. And pretending I'm a Beatle and shaking my head and doing all that, you know, whole nine yards. So yeah. I grew up with them. They're an absolutely, you know, fundamental influence and touchstone through my, you know, my entire life. My brother and I both absolutely bonded, you know, on the Beatles and I want to say, I mean, we were not very old when the whole like backwards music thing,
right.
whatever, you know, that was going on. And my brother was very, very mechanical. I wasn't, you know, I helped him build cars and motorcycles and stuff, but basically I'm the surgical nurse more than the mechanic.
The hand me that wrench guy.
Yeah. Or take this apart and right. you know, set me on it and I can do it. But, you know to do it. No, yeah. No. he took apart our turntable. So he took our turntable and took the mechanism apart so it could freewheel, and they put it back together so we could play the vinyl backwards.
Yeah. That's awesome.
yeah. So that's part of my childhood.
Yeah. That's so cool.
Did you find anything?
nothing that anybody else hadn't heard already. And we didn't, you know, we, of course, we had the American, you know, the American vinyl. So you didn't get like the runouts of like Sgt. Pepper, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? The runout where they have all the nonsense that's repeating in that. You didn't get those in the original in the U.S. vinyl at the time, so mm-hmm. so some of the treats to look for. I distinctly remember him putting the White Album on that, and Revolution 9
backwards, yeah,
and playing that, and him spinning it backwards, mm-hmm. you know, to be like, what are they, you know, what are they doing there?
I can vividly remember having, I think it was Abbey Road, which was my parents' copy. And when I finally, like when I first heard about the Paul is Dead thing, like going, like being home one day and playing that record backwards, like just using my finger to turn it. And my dad came in and was like, you're going to ruin the record player. Like, was furious with me. But yeah. What kind of things do you think, you know, over the 11 years that you've worked on this, on the recording reference manuals, and I guess through your own work as well, you know, what do you feel like you've learned, or what surprised you about what you've learned about this band and about how they make that music?
How much of it was made together as a band surprised me. When I started recording in earnest and starting to get exposure to like recording studios and recording processes. This is in the 70s, and it's an era where songs were constructed more piece at a time. That was a fairly common methodology. Even though, again, now, you know, I've learned since as I've gotten older that no, not all the time. That was my preconception, was that a lot of, you know, that even though they were working with, you know, limited technology, that they were doing it, you know, I thought, you know, they were doing it in a more modern way than they were. Mm-hmm. So there are so many, in fact, the dominant amount of the recording work of the Beatles was done as a group.
Right.
You know, backing tracks where it's almost the entire song was put together in the backing track. That was something that surprised me. I didn't realize how much of a live performance that we're getting out of the Beatles when we listen to their music. Mm-hmm. So that was one aspect of it. The other aspect of it was the work ethic that's exhibited in it, you know, how much work that they did all the time to get there. You know, dig into the recordings, you dig into the records of the recordings, the documentation around the recordings, you know, all you see are the end products typically, right? We see, you know, we get the tape boxes, or we get John Barrett's notes about, you know, about what's contained on a tape, and your front end assumption is that was the work that was done, you know, whatever, they rehearsed the songs at home, they came in and they did their, you know, and they recorded. Well, you know, to a degree that's true, but you know, but then we start to find out and Let It Be really exposed it of like how much work they did. Mm-hmm. They didn't just do that for Let It Be, right? That was the way that they worked. And so with Let It Be, like the rehearsal sessions at Twickenham that they did, mm-hmm. there were days where they did either full or partial takes of songs where over the course of their studio or of their rehearsal day, they were playing like 128 takes in one day. They played like 128 takes of between, you know, 30 takes of I Want You, She's So Heavy and 20 takes of Maxwell's Silver Hammer and 17 takes of Let It Be, and right?
Mm-hmm. Think of,
you know,
away.
I mean,
yeah.
you're a musician.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think of, have you ever been with a band or in a band where they have the patience to bang through even one song?
Nope.
17 times, let alone, you know, 30 times.
Yeah.
And this isn't just like, you know, sometimes they're playing it top to tail. Like if you get, if, if people out there get a chance to get their hands on the Nagra reels, the B-roll audio from the Let It Be era and the Twickenham rehearsals, it's an eye opener as to their process and the work they did and the way that they did it. And again, don't believe for a moment that that's unique to that era. That's the way the Beatles worked. Mm-hmm. That's the way they developed the songs. And so that blew my mind when I thought about it. And again, we have some evidence of it in earlier, it's like in the White Album, there's a reel associated with the White Album where Barrett has noted something like 35 rehearsal takes of, Cry Baby Cry. Yeah. That there's like 35 rehearsal takes that they recorded of that. Mm-hmm. And then when they start really recording, then they just wiped them. You know, they recorded over them, right? But there's some remnants on the reel. But think about that. Think about that. Yeah. That volume of work. And these guys were putting out up to Pepper, they were putting out 2 albums a year. So that's 28 tracks that they were doing there. Plus they were doing 2 singles. Mm-hmm. So 4 more. So on top of touring, television, making movies, doing interviews, these guys in a year are recording 32 songs that are classics.
Yeah.
There was an interview with Ken Scott. Oh, goodness. I'm so old. I lose track of time.
I have no concept of time anymore. Oh, yeah, no. I was like, was that gone 5 years ago or 5 months ago? Hell if I know.
Right.
COVID. Thank you. Thank you. Long lost weekend for all of us.
Goodness.
Scott, the question came to Ken Scott of, what do you think would make music better? You know, this has been the premise is, of course, which I think is false, is like, you know, music now isn't any good. Music then was great. Mm-hmm. But he said, make the artists make more music, make them do more work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was convinced that being forced to get stuff done was a huge creative or contributed to it, the inspiration to create.
Yeah.
Was being under a really bad deadline was really good for creativity because you had to make decisions
and live with it and move on.
Right. There's other artists of that era that were doing the same thing. I mean, think of a little bit later, but like Elton John. You know, Elton John was on that same path of 2 albums a year. Like he had between 70 and 74, I think he had 5 albums or 6 albums.
Wow.
And, you know, so, and those are his greatest albums.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Where he's back to back to back to back to back, you know, record, promote, tour, mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, the Beatles were doing that. So, that sort of thing, when you ask about what was revelatory in this process for me was like, wow, those guys worked their butts off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They really, really did.
Yeah. Why were they the best? Not only innate talent, but they just worked their butts off.
They did the work. Yeah.
Yeah. I
think that's a really good point also, because like when you're forced to work like this, you're just keeping your tools so sharp. And, you know, not to knock, you know, music nowadays, but when people argue about, you know, music nowadays isn't as good, blah, 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 you know, to kind of back what Ken Scott says, you know, a band or an artist will make a record and then they'll tour for 2 years. Then they'll start to make another record and, you know, repeat the process. But you're not kind of just keeping, you know, doing that same kind of thing and just keeping those skills as hot as can be. You know, it's rare to see that kind of schedule anymore, like at all.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't exist for the top tier of the music industry. It just doesn't exist. You know, Justin Timberlake would be five years between albums.
Right.
You know, we know how long it is between Adele's albums because she tells us how old she is.
Well, look at like U2. They're like, so, 10, I think U2 is like 10 years between albums these days. Maybe something like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just the way of the world. You know, you can blame it on economics. Mm-hmm. The biggest bands, they want to make the most money they can make while they can make it. Right.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I'm U2 and you're telling me that, you know, I put out Joshua Tree and I can tour behind that for 2 years or 3 years and be making a lot of money at every stop rather than try to figure out new songs and go write them and record them.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
But again, the contracts and the obligations that the Beatles were under and artists of that era were under were, it was all about producing product.
Mm-hmm.
They had X number of sides a year that they were obligated to make, or they were in violation of their contracts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was the nature of the business. It just so happens that particular alignment in that era happened to be really good for the music that was made.
For sure.
I'm not a troglodyte about music. I mean, I love a lot of modern music, and every year there are some killer albums that come out that just, you know, blow my mind. This year, I'm so in love with Silk Sonic. I mean,
yes.
Oh my gosh.
Holy crap.
It's so good.
It's such a throwback, though. Like,
but like, it's not it doesn't seem like it's, you know, all that tongue in cheek or anything, because like, the songs are that good, but also like, the recording is that good. Mm-hmm. Like, they really put in the effort to, like, I was reading something that they were going through old drum magazines from the time to look at interviews with the players on those like Philly Soul records and then track them down and find out what were you using? What were the heads you were using? How were you tuning your drums? How many, like, what ply shells were you using? Like, they really wanted to like get as accurate as possible to how those records were made. And that's why, one of the reasons why I think it sounds just so good.
Yeah. Well, it's inspired. I mean, the whole, that album is absolutely inspired. And every year, if you take the time to listen, and I'm not talking about like, you know, some backwater of, music that seven people have heard,
right. Right.
I'm talking about, you know, like releases from, you know, major labels. Mm-hmm. There are every year, there's at least a handful of albums that come out that are like just great.
Yeah.
And but again, it's going to be 5 years before that artist does another one, and maybe that ship has sailed by that time.
Right.
Right. And that's a drag, you know, I think about, if we could hear the fullness of their creativity, which is what we get out of the Beatles, right? We get the fullness of their creativity because they had to.
Right. Yeah. You're contractually obligated.
Here's my question, though. Like, I can't stop thinking about, like, if they weren't worked so hard, like, if they weren't under such pressure and had to work so hard and produce so much, like, would they have maybe lasted longer? Like, if they had a little bit better work balance, like work-life balance, like could they have had a longer career instead of just being like, okay, we're out, like we cannot do this anymore?
Well, in the context of the time, they had a very long career, right? Mm-hmm. In the context of the 60s, they had, you know, they were together a decade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even in their early interviews, when, you know, when they're at, you know, they're climbing to the, toppermost of the poppermost, they're saying, yeah, well, you know, I don't know how long this is going to last. You know, it's pop music.
Yeah.
And it's pop music. Who knows how long it's going to last?
Yeah.
And the Beatles were in very many ways, were old school entertainers. You know, think of the things that they were doing. You know, they were showing up on TV, you know, dressing up and doing pantomime and right. You know, they were doing all sorts of, you know, just, they were showing up on comedy shows and doing their shtick, which again was still going on even through the 70s. If you think like the Sonny and Cher show and those kinds of things that were going on, the Beatles were participating in that era of show business and they were showbiz guys. Mm-hmm. You know, McCartney is a pure showbiz guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's forever been his wish to be, you know, like the full meal deal.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to act. He wants to, you know, and unfortunately for Paul, he doesn't do a lot of those things very well.
Not the way of actors. You know,
but what he does do well is he rocks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they sort of went into it knowing or assuming, I guess not knowing, but assuming they had a shelf life.
Sure.
And they were just like, we're just going to ride this as long as it goes. And like, you know.
Yeah, there's the famous interview with Ringo where, you know, like what do you see yourself doing? And he's like, oh, you know, it might be nice to own some hairdresser salons, right?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you know, he's thinking, I'm not going to be drumming for my whole life.
Yeah. And there's so many interviews where they're all saying, oh, you won't see me doing this by the time I'm 30, let alone 40. You know, nobody wants to see, you know, old gray-haired men, you know, singing I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Meanwhile, people paid $300 a ticket to now see.
That's the cheap seats.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the cheap seats.
Right.
That was the, you know, that, but, you know, back to the, you know, what you learn or what I learned through this deep dive was the, from the Beatles was the work ethic. From the recording point of view was, you know, EMI was a factory. Mm-hmm. EMI was a hit factory.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't making great recordings just for the Beatles. They were making great recordings for whoever walked through the door.
Yeah.
And they had a process down to a T of how to make a great sounding record. And that applied to everybody. And then, of course, everyone benefited from the way the Beatles kind of pushed the envelope there. Think of the Hollies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Hollies records sound fantastic.
So good. Yeah.
And why? Well, they got the same team working, you know, save Martin. I don't think Martin produced any of the Hollies stuff, but save for Martin, the technical team, for everyone from, you know, Townsend to the engineers and that, you know, it's the EMI, it's the house, you know, it's the house staff that's working for everybody. So the lessons that you learn on the Beatles now get applied to the Hollies. I always think of, he ain't heavy, he's my brother.
Yeah.
Right?
Great sounding.
Think of the bass sound on that song.
Mm-hmm.
And now think of the bass sound on Pepper.
Yeah, it's that thuddy kind of, you know, almost thick, like an upright but real thick sounding.
Yeah. It's a great description of it. It's got all those acoustic bass qualities to it. Well, they learned on Pepper. You know, if I'm the Hollies,
right. You gotta do it.
I'm like, what started me down the road? You associate these things with success, and artists always do that. You know, we all of us from the, you know, whether you're in the background doing producing and engineering or in the foreground as an artist, you know, we all stand on the shoulders of giants, right? We all stand on the shoulders of those that came before us, and so but the ones that came before you are literally the ones that just left the studio. You're like, hey,
don't change those settings.
You know, yeah. Don't change those settings.
Yeah.
Don't need to change a thing. Let's just go in and record this.
It's almost like the production staff's like a production version of like the Wrecking Crew. Like,
no, absolutely. That's absolutely right. I completely agree with that statement.
Yeah,
they really were. You know, that studio is running at least 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And
probably close to 24 hours a day.
Well, they ran three shifts, and, you know, until the Beatles came and just kind of did their own thing and pissed people off because, you know, I want to go home.
Right.
They ran three shifts. They started at 10 a.m. And there were three-hour sessions that took them a dinner break or breaks between that took them to 10 p.m. But 10 p.m., the studio, you know, go home.
Yeah.
Studio's closed. But again, you know, think about that. Once again, the idea is I'm going in, and in my 3 hours, I'm cutting a record.
Yeah.
It isn't, we'll see what happens, man.
We'll get drum sounds.
Yeah, we'll get drum sounds. We'll get tuned. Ugh. We'll get the tape reeled up. It was, we are making a record. We're
making the record, yeah.
Come in, you'll come in ready to make a record, and we're going to make a record.
Yeah.
You know, again, it seems like that was an environment where the Beatles really responded well.
Yeah.
And they had no problem with that demand being made of them. And why didn't they have a problem with it? It's because that's the way it was done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and remember, they're kids. Mm-hmm. They're kids when the band breaks up. They're kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So... Yeah, I put this in volume three about Pepper. Was there's a Danny Harrison story or George Harrison story about Danny Harrison, and Danny graduates from university and he's 23 years old. He graduates from university and George, is like, you know, son, you know, congratulations, you know, it's great, you know, got your degree. And he goes, 23. He goes, jeez, what was I doing when I was 23? And he goes, oh, yeah, Pepper.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's savage.
And now here's another one. Here's another one. If you don't know this, that might blow your mind. Jeff Emmerich engineers Revolver at age 18.
Wow.
Engineers. And wins a Grammy Award for Pepper at age 19.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
That's bonkers.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's a little thing he did.
Yeah. I definitely had that thought when I turned 30. You know, just being a Beatle nerd, I was like, well, let's see. By 30, what had John and Paul done? Oh, everything. What have I done? Not much. It's interesting, like, you know, just what a different cloth these people's output is cut from, I think, you know.
Well, here you are at 40 and you have a podcast.
I am the American dream personified. Yeah. I think.
And nothing wrong with that.
Right. Well, I think this is actually a really good turning point to turn to this week's song, because I think this is really a good example of what we're talking about. So let's go ahead and switch gears over. And coming in this week at number 141 is Anytime at All.
Anytime at all. Anytime at all. Anytime at all. All you gotta do is go, and I'll be there. If you need somebody to love, just look into my eyes. I'll be there to make you feel right. If you're feeling sorry and sad, I'd really sympathize. Don't you be sad, just call me tonight. Anytime at all.
It's interesting to think that in 12 months, the Beatles had gone from recording almost an entire album in one day to showing up at EMI's Abbey Road Studios with songs just half complete. But by the spring of 1964, as the biggest thing in the world, that's exactly where the Beatles were. Now, following a much-deserved vacation in May of 64, the Beatles turned up to the studio on June 2nd to record the last three songs needed for the album, which would be the companion to the film A Hard Day's Night, whose production had wrapped at the end of April. So, beginning the session with seven takes of John's Anytime at All, the band felt something was still needed for the song, so they decided to switch gears and focus on Things We Said Today. The band take a break after finishing that song, which I think took them about 2 hours to do. during which time they apparently, during this break, they apparently work out a bridge for Any Time At All. And following another couple hour session where they knock out John's When I Get Home, they start work again on Any Time At All, and this time needing only 4 takes to get a satisfactory master take. Now, it would seem obvious that they maybe intended to have a vocal over this bridge section, but working under such time constraints, they either never get around to it, or they figured it worked just fine as an instrumental passage. So after recording the 4 takes that they run through, they work out John's double-track vocal, which is done more out of necessity to accommodate the vocal passages that kind of flow in and out of each other. And following the addition of Paul's vocal, Paul then adds the piano throughout the verse and the bridge. And then following the addition of John's final 2 strums added as an overdub, the song is wrapped up. In that evening, they write the bridge of it, they record the whole thing, done. So the song's released in July of 64 on the Hard Day's Night album in the UK and the rest of the world, and on the US Capitol album Something New. Interestingly enough, as not fairly uncommon though, was never performed live by the band or any of its solo members. So why do I have Any Time At All at number 141? So I really always enjoyed this song on kind of a number of different levels. It's really kind of striking out the box the way it really pulls your attention in with this massive sounding snare hit. And then John's raspy voice just comes in with this real authority. It's an intro I can still kind of remember the first time I heard it and that feeling of kind of being caught off guard by it. I love the back and forth vocal interplay of John and Paul in the chorus. And, you know, both really at these kind of strong higher ends of their ranges where they're really pushing it. And then the verse settles in with John in this kind of nice lower baritone register. It's a great dynamic shift, I think, even though the band doesn't shift their performance dynamic-wise, it brings the song down really nicely in the verses. Melodically, I think it's interesting because this is kind of out of John's wheelhouse. You know, usually, and we've discussed this on other songs before, he kind of likes to do melodies that are like 1 or 2 notes and really focus the emphasis more on the lyric. Paul, on the other hand, will lean a lot on vocal movement and really move up and down throughout the melody. But here, John's kind of got this really nice kind of ascending melody that kind of goes up and up, dances around a bit before going up again for a second, and then tumbles back down to the root note he started the melody with. So there's a tension that kind of builds where the melody isn't doing what you think it would, and you're not sure where it's going to go, and that's kind of echoed by the tension in the song, you know, kind of bouncing between major and minor chords also. I think also there's a sonic quality on this song that's really, really strong. It's got all the hallmarks of all the Beatlemania, you know, early era Beatles. George's 12-string sounds really, really great here. Ringo's drums especially really propel the song forward. Now, also, this is the night before he collapses from tonsillitis, and he's on record saying how miserable he was during this session. So even when he's miserable, he's just got such amazing groove and power and feel. I know John's on record saying the song wasn't really all that much to write home about, just kind of turning out a rehash of something he'd already written earlier to finish the record. But all the ingredients here make for a song that's way more mature sounding, I think, than a lot of it their contemporaries were putting out at the time as filler tracks. And I think it's a perfect combination of kind of great writers and performers working with a great producer and a great production team to make a really great sounding pop song. So that's my thought on it. Jerry, I throw it to you. What do you think about Any Time At All?
I put it in a category of what McCartney used to call work songs. Mm-hmm. So the idea being that they could, you know, they could write these 7 days a week if they chose to.
Yeah.
Like when they were in the Beatlemania groove, this is the sort of thing could come out. What strikes me about the track is, to me, it has all the hallmarks of a George Martin production. The way that it opens with the snare drum, which was an overdub, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, to reinforce it. To give it that punch, you know, let's give those snare, you know, those snare hits at the top of each verse, or top of each chorus. The arrangement approach to me is, it has Martin's, you know, fingerprints all over it. You've got the descending piano line with the ascending vocal,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that very, classic counterpoint where we're moving the music in 2 directions simultaneously is, again, it's something you learn in music school.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, Beatles didn't go to music school. So, you know, to me, it's got all the hallmarks of Martin, where it's smartened up, like the highlights, like what can we bring to the surface out of a very kind of basic rock and roller. All of those things are done with it, and to me, that's Martin's fingerprints that are all over the whole thing. I mean, it's a cool recording. It definitely has a texture to it that is, I think you said, like, fires or checks all the Beatlemania boxes, as you were mentioning. 12 string guitar. It's got a couple of acoustics on it. It's got the piano reinforcing, you know, reinforcing the solo, you know, a la Hard Day's Night, right? You know, all of those easy wins for them because they had done them before, mm-hmm. right? They'd figured out that these elements work, and so they reapply them to this track. Certainly, the fact that it starts with the chorus.
They do love that.
Right? Yeah, well, it's very much a Martin thing. Mm-hmm. It's very much a Martin thing of let's turn this around and see if this makes it better. You know, a producer's role is to take the raw contents of a song and say, how does this make the most sense to suck somebody in and to keep their attention? And, you know, it opens like Rock Around the Clock. Bah, 1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's doing that kind of classic approach to it of like, I'm going to get your attention and now I'm going to keep it.
Right.
And I love the counterpoint, as you mentioned, I love the counterpoint between John and Paul. I love the double tracked vocals. I love the double tracked acoustic guitar. All of those things build this kind of nice sort of washy texture in the background that, again, punctuated and broken up by that absolutely crushing snare shot mm-hmm. that happens, you know, and it gets our attention every time.
Yeah.
So think about it. When, you know, save from Rock Around the Clock, can you think of even half a dozen songs where a single snare shot is the hook?
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Ooh, Dave Matthews Band.
Yes.
I was like, I know I have to think of one. I was like, ooh, ooh.
Well done. You know exactly what's coming. Yep.
Valid. Good point. Well done.
I knew a music thing.
You did it.
No, that's right on. And it's interesting that you can create a hook, because as soon as you hear that snare, you know exactly what's coming. And if you're, you know, jamming out to that chorus in your car, as soon as you hear that pow, you know, anytime, like, you're just going for it. Because it's a hook, yeah.
Yeah, and that was not meant to take away from your point at all, because I think it's like, that's the only one I can think of. There's, like you said, there's very few, and that's iconic. Like when you, if you grew up around the time that we did or were aware of music, you know, in the late 90s, I guess that was when they were popular, like late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah, somewhere in there. And like, that song was huge. Ants Marching? Yep. Yeah, the song was huge. Like, you heard that snare and you're listening to like radio. You're like, oh, I know what's coming. It's yeah. Matthew. Like, it's, you know what it is. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's definitely an attention getter.
Yeah. And, but it's a rare device, right? It's a rare device for, you know, when we think of hooks, we think of melody. You don't think of a snare shot.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they're hearkening back to, this is something I'm a musician too. So I mean, I know how this is how it works, because it's how it works for me, is we are always influenced. We're always influenced by what we grew up with, but we're more influenced actually by who our idols grew up with.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, the Beatles, you know, grew up with the early days of rock and roll,
mm-hmm.
you know, So when we listen to the, if you listen through the Beatles back to the late 50s and early 60s, before they were the Beatles, that's where you'll hear what they're really doing. Yeah. You know, Ringo was as much a, Ringo was a rock and roll drummer, but rock and roll drummers weren't rock and roll drummers. They were jazz drummers.
Yeah, like right? Charlie Watts.
But yeah, then, Charlie, Watt, well, so Charlie Watts never more... like he never let go of it. Yeah. He never let go of it. But the drummers that became rock and roll drummers, right? They came from, you know, they learned from an earlier tradition. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's what's going on, you know, with the Beatles. So, and going on with Martin, you know, the lessons you learn are, and let's not forget, Bill Haley was huge in the UK.
Yeah.
Right. So taking a page from Rock Around the Clock to start Anytime at All is actually a very natural through line mm-hmm. for music.
For sure.
You find it all, you know, you find it all along. Think of, you know, this going on completely on a tangent here, but if you think of this kind of the show tune bent that McCartney's got, mm-hmm. why does he got it? You know, his dad was in a jazz band.
Yeah.
His dad had a jazz band. He loved that crap. When he grew up, he was listening to, you know, show tunes. Mm-hmm. You know, which developed, frankly,
yeah, music hall.
That's... Yeah, and so really developed, and that for McCartney, and luckily for us, he was, because for him it developed this sense of melody.
Yeah.
With Broadway or whatever, you know, show tunes, there's a huge melodic arc in a lot of the music. You know, the melody is very important to carry carry the song. And McCartney internalized that, and he gave us in pop and rock and roll these great melodies. They just happen to have, you know, a killer groove behind them. Mm-hmm. You know, so the Beatles were great in that they were, you know, thoroughly modern, but whether they were conscious of it or not, they were also bringing forward all of this music history with them. Mm-hmm. That always occurs to me when I'm listening to the Beatles is this is what I'm hearing is reflecting what they grew up on. Mm-hmm. Right. It's not just contemporary. It's not just them competing with the Beach Boys or them competing, you know, with whoever in the UK in the period, competing with other Mersey bands or whatever, or later, you know, with the Stones or whatever's going on, right? Mm-hmm. That's not really where it's coming from. It's where it has to live because that's the marketplace that they were working in. But when a song is bubbling up in their heads, it's born of all of those childhood influences and all of those things all mixed together.
Yeah.
So with Anytime at All, you get this, it's a really early rock and roll track. Now what they layer on it are what they learned in their own work of, mm-hmm. hey, this works. You know, 12-string guitar sounding pretty good this time around. You know, let's use that. Yeah. So, there's my long-winded take on it.
I love it, Julia. What do you think on this one?
I really like this song.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all said it. I've even said it at this point now. Just like that drum hit at the top that just like grabs your attention, is just so cool. And then the vocal comes in, it's John, right? That's singing. Mm-hmm. Like his raspy vocal is just like rocking, which I feel like that's pretty rocking for back then, right? Like, I'm not sure where it sits.
I mean, this is 64, you know, so it's, you know, year one of American Beatlemania, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's always got this kind of like raspy kind of yell that he does, that shout, that thing that he can do, like going back to like Twist and Shout's a prime example, but like he always has this real rasp when he really pushes his voice.
Yeah, I think it sounds great. And I think it nicely lends itself to the sort of the subject matter of the song. Like, and I really like the subject matter of the song because it's one of those songs that at first listen, like you might think it's one of their sort of like romantic love songs, but it's not necessarily about romantic love. Like, sure. I really think this is about like the dear friendships maybe between the four of them and like just sort of that like, I'll always be here. Like we have each other, you know, like yeah. I'm here for you kind of thing, which I think is like a really lovely sentiment. And for him to push the vocals so much to like emphasize how strongly he feels this way about whoever he's singing this about.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just like adds to it for me. I don't know. I really enjoy that about this song.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. I did have a question, though. Like, can you talk a little bit more about the part in your notes where you said John's got this really nice ascending melody that kind of goes up and up, dances around a bit before going up again, and then tumbles back down to the root note he starts with. Is that referring to the chorus, or is that somewhere else in the song?
Talk about in the verse. Because usually in a verse, he'll do kind of like a one or two note kind of run is kind of his part and parcel, like his usual thing. Like a prime example is like, I should have known better. Da 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 da. That I would love everything that you do. Like he likes to kind of stay on one note and let the word be what's the focal point.
Okay.
And then on this one, he's got this melody that starts, you know, if you need somebody to love, da 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 da. So it moves moving up and up and da 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 da. So it kind of moves up and up and then back down to the note that it starts at. At the end of the line.
So is this a McCartney song? Is this a McCartney song that Lennon sang?
It's from what they say, it's like an all John song, except for the bridge, which they think is a McCartney thing.
Who said that?
The they.
The mysterious they.
If only there were a book with these notes.
They said it?
I believe even Paul's on record as saying that this was a John song, though. But yeah, it seems like.
Do you have this in your book?
I would assume this is in volume one.
No, I do not fight this fight. I do not fight.
Of who wrote what?
That is a fight where I would end up bloodied and bruised. I don't fight it.
But
Lennon, I agree with you. Lennon in the early years had some trademarks, for lack of a better word, around his compositions. But, you know, clearly if he wanted to, he could take a melody anywhere.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, certainly, in the, you know, in 67, 68, you know, he was for my dollar more inventive than McCartney melodically.
Interesting.
Flat out musically.
Yeah.
Like think of the time signatures that he's playing with on the White Album.
Yeah.
Just
like a Happiness is a Warm kinda, Gun, that Mother yeah, Superior and, transition. Yeah.
Yeah. And those aren't, and those aren't like, those songs were recorded of a piece.
Yeah.
Took him a long time to get it right because that's the way he wrote the track.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote the track to shift and move like that. But yeah, he's, it's interesting. I said what I said about, you know, he's singing a McCartney song with any time at all, kind of, tongue in cheek, because Lennon holds his own every day with McCartney melodically.
Mm-hmm.
There's, it isn't like the stereotype of John the rocker and Paul the melody guy. I don't subscribe.
Not at all. Those are interchangeable completely.
Both ways. Yeah. Yeah. They both rocked and they both could do melodies that would just absolutely break your heart. And so, I think with this, when you like, you just sing anytime at all, it's a killer melody.
Mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. There really is a very, very nice structure that, you know, that he came up with there. So, but then again, so here I'll do a, do another sidebar of, remember though, what we've learned, if you guys have, you know, seen the Get Back, you know, if you've sat through 3 days of that.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
How collaborative they truly were in these processes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And again, don't for a minute, you know, podcast listeners, don't for a moment think that that was exclusive to Get Back or exclusive to that era. It wasn't. That was the way that the Beatles worked. And poor Mal Evans, you know, having to run around and find a piece of paper to write down the lyrics. Right. I swear, half of the lyric collectors out there that think they're getting a McCartney handwritten lyric are probably getting Mal Evans.
Mal Evans.
handwritten lyrics. They were highly collaborative, mm-hmm. and highly competitive. So that's, all of those things are happening all the time with the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anytime at all, if you take away, you know, take everything away and just play that as a song, you know, play it as a ballad, you know, take away the snare shot. It's a very nice song.
Yeah, mm-hmm. for sure.
I don't feel like this is a throwaway at all.
That's the funny thing.
I think it's such a jam. I think it has great energy. Like, I would never, I'm really surprised that what did you say? John was just like, this was just like a whatever.
But he says that about a lot of stuff. I mean, you can't always take him at his word.
That's fair.
And in context of you could see, like, you know, if they take a short time to dash it off, right? And a very compact recording, a couple of sessions. You know, I can see that, you know, they would view it as just like, yeah, you know, in the context of what we've done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just a, you know, it was a filler piece.
Yeah.
But the Beatles filler pieces were other people's hit records.
Yeah. And yeah. They almost never treat them as filler pieces because there are plenty of bands from around that time who have filler tracks on records that sound like filler tracks. And this does not sound like the work of a filler track. Mm-hmm. Like, you could tell that they put the time and the work into it. You know, everybody involved, you know, worked to make the best product they could at every moment. And I think that's such a testament to why these songs hold up like they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, they're the Beatles. I mean, it's the you know, singing the phone book thing.
Yeah.
You know, right? They could probably sing the phone book and make it sound like the Beatles.
It would be great.
And we'd be like, I never knew the phone book was so deep.
I can't wait for the box set reissue.
is Giles gonna do a remix of it?
Oh, I can't wait.
You would buy it.
Oh, in a heartbeat. In an absolute heartbeat.
I'm like, hun, what's this charge? And you're like, Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. Comes in a wooden box that's 8 feet wide, and oh man. So how do we feel? I know you don't deal in opinions.
No, it comes in a phone booth.
Oh, it comes in a full phone booth. Jerry, I know you said you don't really deal in opinions, especially in terms of the reference manuals, but if I can twist your arm, at number 141 out of 223, would you say I'm way off? Like, am I out of bounds? How do you feel about this? Where would you put it if you?
No,
were...
I think you're about right. I think it's about right. It's you know, if we take it on its own, as we've been talking about it on its own, mm-hmm. you know, it's clear that it's a cool track. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of really great things about it. But in the context of the, you know, the Beatles' entire catalog and output, it probably falls there right in the lower end of the middle ground. You know, it's not Mr. Moonlight.
Indeed, you know, it's not.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it's not I and the Walrus. It's, you know, it's, and, you know, frankly, for me, the the kind of the Beatlemania era has a lot of these things going on, you know, especially when you get up into the like Beatles for Sale, where they kind of run out of steam and run out of, and they start covering, you know, Carl Perkins and stuff. Right. You know, they've, you know, they've run out of gas a little bit. And so, yeah, this is definitely right in the middle ground. So I think your placement of it is pretty good. Excellent. If you're gonna rank it, I think it's pretty good.
what do you think?
Pretty accurate for me.
Awesome.
I feel like I'd move it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Like I like it a little bit better, but not super far. Like I'm not moving it up to the top 50 or anything.
Okay.
But I think I'd move it up a little bit. I really like this song.
Okay.
I think it's fun.
Is it breaking above the middle ground though, or is it below the middle? What's their total output? 200 something?
223 is what I have. So
half of that is 110.
I'm glad you're good at math. So would you put this in like the 120s? Yeah,
I stuck at it too. Actually, right? So actually in that context, I would probably rate it lower.
Okay.
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I'm terrible at math too. My wife.
Is she good at math?
Yeah, she's kind of really
every
smart.
Musician
she's
finds like, the yin to that mathematical yang.
Yeah.
A checking book. What is this?
Yeah. Everyone says, oh, you're a musician. You should be really good at math. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Well, not in Rush. Like
yeah. So sorry, I have to retract. To me it's in the 110s.
Okay. So maybe a little better than I've got it. Okay.
Yeah, it's standing on its own, standing in isolation, it's a cool track. Mm-hmm. In context of all of their work, it's pretty average.
Sure. Okay.
And you know, yeah, there's not anything like remarkable about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it to me, that's what gets you higher.
Yeah.
Is there are moments upon moments, or there's something that is new and revelatory about how they recorded it, or there's a you know, some sort of breakthrough in the way that the songwriting or the performance or the arrangement, there's those kinds of things. And they've got so much of that they do, you know, time and again, mm-hmm. that, you know, again, the Beatlemania era is lots of cool stuff to sing along with, but you know, it just, the music being made was pretty, you know, meat and potatoes, rock and roll for the most part.
Yeah.
And that really, honestly, for me, is where this song falls. You know, it's really tasty meat and potatoes.
Right. For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
But it's still just meat and potatoes.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I can see that. Yeah.
I love it. Well, I think that's a good stopping point there. Before we wrap up for the day, Jerry, can I throw some rapid fire questions at you?
Sure.
Okay. He's like, will I answer them? Maybe not.
Yeah, we'll see how rapidly I fire back.
They're almost never rapid fire.
Yeah, it's fine.
Your favorite Beatles song, and it can be of all time, it can be today, whatever floats your boat.
Yeah, that's almost impossible for me. Songs that stick with me, "Babies in Black,"
Oh, how long will it take?
Chills almost every time I heard it from the first time I ever heard it until today. This Boy.
Oh, yes.
Just phenomenal performance. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful song. It's All Too Much.
Yeah.
It is a super cool song. Mm-hmm. The ridiculous feedback, the weird arrangement, you know, very, very cool track. And, you know, and then, you know, greatest hits, greatest hits, greatest hits, greatest hits, you know, Walrus, Day in the Life, that whole, you know, 67, 68 era is just super rich for me and for my, you know, for my ears.
Yeah.
And, and I keep going back to it. I love, you know, I love the output at the end. You know, I love, of course, you know, Abbey Road is a masterwork. And Let It Be, for all of its, the album, for all of its failings on one hand, it never, it's just ingrained in me. Mm-hmm. And it's such an easy album to love if you let yourself love it.
Yeah.
And I have no biases against, you know, Phil Spector or any of that crap. I mean, you know, it's the album we got, and that's okay by me.
You would hope that your lackluster album is as good as Let It Be by the Beatles.
That's right. No, that's a wonderful way to put it.
Like, if only that were my worst
album.
I
can only hope that one day I make an album as crappy as Let It Be.
Right? Like, man, they really crapped the bed here. Did they?
Yeah.
Your least favorite Beatles song. Do you have a least favorite?
Oh, yeah. Easily the album version of Mr. Moonlight.
Yeah.
Oh. While the Star Club version of Mr. Moonlight is killer.
Pretty killer. Yep.
But, Mr. Moonlight is just a train wreck.
Yeah.
You know,
it starts out so promising.
His
vocal is so good there at the top, but then it's, you get, you know, 3 seconds after that, it's just down the tubes.
Well, the organ was a mistake.
Oh, for
sure. The organ,
for sure.
The dominant organ for a guitar band, not a great way to do it. And that's absolutely proven out by the Star Club version.
Yeah.
Star Club version, you're just like rocking.
Yeah.
And you hear in the Star Club version what that track could have been.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes what they recorded even worse than it was before you heard the Star Club version.
Yeah.
So that's easily my least favorite. I don't really even register their, you know, their covers that well.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned on the For Sale album, the, you know, Honey Don't and those kinds of things. It just, everybody's trying to be my baby. Those are the Beatles filler tunes.
Yeah.
In a way that when they were doing with Please Please Me, when they're covering, you know, when they've got Anna and these kinds of songs and Chains and that, completely different feel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that just don't connect. Mr. Moonlight and some of the stuff from Beatles for Sale. And then, you know, on the flip side, Beatles for Sale has one of, I think, the greatest moments they recorded, which is that bridge on Babies in Black. This is so good. So good.
Yeah. Your favorite Beatles album?
It really changes with the season and changes with the moods.
Mm-hmm.
I play the pants off of so many of them. When I was, you know, very, very young, it was the US, you know, the US Beatles second album.
Mm.
Right. You know, when I learned what their catalog really was, then Hard Day's Night is an absolutely dynamite album. Help is a dynamite album. Rubber Soul. I mean, yeah, it depends. It depends on the day and depends on the mood. You know, I'm assuming you've got, you know, fans that of your podcast that understand, you know, the fundamental differences in the US versus the UK releases.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in every possible way, the UK releases are better. They're more, they flow better. They make more sense together. It's, it's very, very hard to pick a favorite. You put any one of them on and you're like, that's a great album.
Right.
That's such a great album.
I think I agree with you on the US versus UK records. The only exception maybe being Rubber Soul, because it's just a very different overall experience.
Well, that's the thing. Like in the US, Rubber Soul feels like a country rock album.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
It really does feel like a country rock album. And then you learn that they stole stuff from Help.
Yeah.
You know, to make it. And they left out stuff that was really pointing you where they were going.
Yeah.
So the unfortunate thing about the US release of Rubber Soul is it's a step backwards in time.
Yeah.
Where the UK's Rubber Soul is another step forwards in time for them.
Yeah.
Because they're doing, you know, Dr. Robert and stuff. And Your Bird Can Sing, right? Mm-hmm.
That's Revolver, but...
Oh, Revolver. Sorry about that.
But that stuff ends up with some of the stuff left off Rubber Soul on Yesterday and Today.
Yeah, I can't keep them straight.
I don't even think they can at this point. So.
But again, yeah, Rubber Soul in the U.S. feels backward leaning.
Yeah.
And Rubber Soul in the U.K. feels like it's taking me up to Revolver.
Yeah.
You know, it's leading me there, and in all of the right ways, the sophistication of the recordings, the sophistication of the songs, all of that are leading me to what they end up doing with Revolver.
Yeah.
And the US version doesn't feel like that, but I agree with you. It's a great country rock album.
Yeah.
You know,
just a whole different world, but yeah, I think that's right on. Last one. Do you have a favorite memory associated with the Beatles or a Beatles song or an album or some Beatle moment for you?
Yeah, I mean the Beatles are my childhood. The Beatles are, you know, the Beatles are you know, along with Elton John, my other great favorite. The Beatles are why I became a musician. The Beatles are, you know, they're everything that way. But probably, you know, my sweetest Beatle memories are just me and my older brother in the back room of a little Rambler in Seattle playing Magical Mystery Tour over and over and over and over. And we would get on our birthday cakes, we would get Beatle, little plastic Beatles on our birthday cakes.
Nice.
And we would stick them to the middle of the record so the Beatles were performing for us.
That's awesome. That's so cool. That's,
yeah, really so cute. So the memories are very, it's the Beatles are their family, you know, they're family to me. They bring memories of family for me. And you know, the best memories of family for me.
Yeah.
And you know, and you know, obviously, you know, the Beatles are fundamental to my life. And who would have thought? I never would have thought I would end up doing what I'm doing, that I would be able to, you know, have a little place in the Beatles story. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I've been able to meet some, you know, people that had their hands on them, you know, and interact with those guys. I mean, Ken Townsend, I got, you know, to hang with Ken Townsend, who fundamentally changed recording.
Yeah.
You know, thank you, Beatles. You know, thank you. And yeah, all because of them, all because of the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And forever grateful, forever a fan, forever appreciative of them. And too many sweet memories to I'd bore you to death with them all.
Well, I love it. That's absolutely fantastic. So volume 5 of the Beatles Recording Reference Manual is the most recent book. Where can everybody pick that one up and the previous 4? Follow along with everything that you're up to.
Yeah, Amazon everywhere. Well, almost everywhere. But, you know, certainly North America, Europe, the UK, Japan, Australia, if you're in any of those markets, It's easy to just get on your Amazon site and you can get it. You can learn more about the books at the website, which is Beatles Recording Reference Manuals.com, plural, referencemanuals.com. I couldn't think of a longer URL, so so I stuck with that one. There's a couple more Beatle related work or books in the works that I've got going now. I'm not quite ready to tell the world what they're going to be, except to say they're going to be super cool.
Awesome. That's all we need to hear. That's all I got to hear.
Do you have any social media where people can follow along and wait for super cool announcements?
I'm out there on Facebook, so you can track me down there. There's a Beatles Recording Reference Manuals Facebook page. There's Jerry Hammack Facebook page. So, you know, come say hi. If you're interested in the recording stuff that I do, there's a jerryhammack.com where you can track down what I'm doing on that end of my life, in my spare time.
When not writing 8 books at the same time. Oh man. Jerry, this has been a blast, man. Thank you so much for taking time to hang out with us today. We hope you've enjoyed it. And, you know, we've got another 140 of these songs to go. And you've got like 3 more books coming out. So we'll have to do this again when the next one's coming out.
Love to. Yeah. Thank you guys for inviting me and, had a lot of fun talking Beatles like I always do, and you guys are a joy. So thanks a lot.
Jerry Hammack, everybody, talking about Anytime at All at number 141. What a blast. That was such a fun conversation. I love talking about the technical aspects of how Beatles records were made.
You truly do.
And
I am not the person to have those discussions with. So I'm glad that you have a new friend that you can talk about that stuff with.
Yeah. But, you know, it really is amazing the amount of work they did and the time that they did it, the quality of the work that they did. And, you know, you can tell, you know, they're not just tossing things off to finish the record. They're really putting the work in. And I think that's one of the reasons why this music, you know, stands the test of time is it's, you know, there's so much amazing stuff out there. So much good stuff. Friends, what do y'all think about Anytime at All at 141? Am I too high? Am I too low? Or, Julia?
Don't say it.
Don't say what? Am I just like Baby Bear's porridge as I pinch her cheek just right? Let us know what you guys think on all of our social medias. If you're not following us on Facebook, you can follow us at
Ranking the Beatles.
Or you can find us on Instagram at
Ranking the Beatles.
Or follow on Twitter at
Ranking Beatles.
Yeah, buddy. And be sure to check out our website, which is
www.rankingthebeatles.com.
And on that website, if you're enjoying the show and enjoying what we do and want to, you know, kind of show your appreciation, you can buy us a cup of coffee. Just click the little buy me a coffee button. Or you can grab a t-shirt.
You can show everyone your appreciation by wearing a t-shirt.
A t-shirt, a jumper, a sweatshirt.
Oh, we have sweatshirts?
We do have sweatshirts.
Ooh, I want a sweatshirt.
We have unisex t-shirts, ladies t-shirts.
We have a poster. We have
if you want to rank your own Beatles, you can get this beautiful 18 by 24 inch poster. It's got every song chronologically by album. And you little slot next to it, you just put what number you think that song would be at. So grab one of those. Tell all your friends. Show them what you're doing. Let them realize that you're a big, big nerd, too. And, so I hope you guys have enjoyed this episode. I had a good time. Did you enjoy it, Julia?
I did.
Wonderful. Well, let's wrap it up. We will see y'all next time. So until then, take care of yourselves. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Julia.
And this has been Ranking the Beatles. Adios.
Bye, y'all.